One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Football, fighting, and full on nonsense. The Stephen Housen Podcast. Made in Manchester.
Hello everybody, this is Stephen Housen. This is the Warm Down Podcast, and this is a little bit of a special one. It's not Monday, it's Tuesday today, and hopefully it'll still be Tuesday by the time this goes out. And I am delighted to be joined by the one and only Jimmy Conrad. Jimmy, what's happening, my mate?
Hey, what's up? Thanks for having me on the show. I've a long-time follower, first-time interviewee, so I'm excited to be here.
Just guest, mate. There's no interviews here. It's just a conversation between two people that like football, and we're not going to call it soccer. We are going to call it football. That's the only rules that I'm going to stipulate.
Yeah.
For those that don't know Jimmy, I don't know where you've been, but Jimmy's a former MLS player, also played over in Europe, and is now cruising the YouTube highway. Jimmy, tell us how you got to where you are.
Yeah, good question. So I don't know how far you want to go back, but with regard to playing, I did the university route here in the States. I didn't get drafted. We have a draft over here in the United States. I wasn't one of those draft pick guys. I had to work my way through the lower leagues to get up to the top. We have another player that you guys might be familiar with, Jada Merritt, another American international who didn't really get scouted heavily here in the States, went over and worked his way up to Watford, scored a game-winning goal to get them promoted to the Premier League. Great story. Now, mine's not as exciting as that, as it ties into the Premier League, but I do have some similarities of kind of fighting for what I got. And him and I both started in the Copa America together in 2007. I put in the World Cup in 06. So I'm a little bit like the little engine that could. So that's kind of my backstory.
Let's back the fuck up a second. You can't just say I played in a World Cup and just like casually just drop it like that. I mean, that's a massive thing, regardless of whatever country you're from. I know it's still a relative niche sport in America, but come on, playing in a World Cup surely is any football fan's dream. You can't just dismiss it the way you did.
No, you're right. You're right. It was a dream of mine and a dream I didn't think was possible. But as I kept working hard and working on my game day in and day out, I thought, all right, I'm getting a little bit closer and a little bit closer. And if I could just get into the national team, I'll prove to the coaches that I deserve to be there. And I never really got ahead of myself. I obviously dreamed big, but I tried to keep it based in reality, just one step at a time. So when I did get into the national team, I just be like, listen, I just want to get invited back to the next camp. I don't even care if I play. Then I got invited back to the back camp, and I'm like, all right, it would be cool just to make the 18. So then I made the 18. And then you get there, and you're like, you know what? It'd actually be awesome to play. So then, you know, you start to play, and then you start to like, all right, well, I'm a year out of the World Cup. If I continue to play well, maybe they'll take me. And I got named to the team. I was a big surprise, I think, for a lot of people. But I got named to the team. And then you realize, because you kill yourself in that month before the World Cup starts. Usually most countries have a one-month training camp. And I was killing myself in that. And you realize, you know, it's cool to make the World Cup and to go with the team, but it would be awesome to play. So thankfully, I got to play. I played against Italy, and I played against Ghana. I started against Ghana and came on halfway through against Italy. That was the only game they didn't win, the 06 World Cup. They ended up winning it. I switched jerseys with Pirlo after the game, which is a big thrill because he's a player that I
really admire. Please tell me you've still got that.
Well, I do. No, I do and I don't, because what happened was, here's the fun backstory. My club in MLS, Kansas City, there was four of us that were going to be, we're on the bubble to go to the World Cup. And three of us got named, and the other guy did not. His name is Kerry Savagnin. He's the assistant coach now. And I told him, because he was gutted. He was like, that was it. He was 30, 31. That was his only chance of going to a World Cup. And so I said, hey, man, if you know the teams that we're playing, if there's any jersey I can get for you, who would you want me to get? And he said, Andrea Pirlo. So I had made it a goal of mine to do that. So after the game, when I got to play, Del Piero came up to me, and he asked if he wanted to switch jerseys. I waved him off. I waved off Del Piero, which is like ridiculous, right? Because Alessandro Del Piero is the man. But I had said that I already had made plans to switch with Pirlo. So I go over to Pirlo, and I switched jerseys with him. And when I came back to the States, I gave that jersey to my teammate and friend.
Everybody needs a mate like Jimmy Conrad. That's an awesome little
story.
And you also captained America as well, haven't you? What was that like?
It's amazing. You know, it's pretty surreal. The first, I did it 5 or 6 times, and the first time I was really nervous. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to act, even though I was captain of my MLS team. It's different with the national team. I mean, you're representing every single person in this country, and so the weight of it can be a lot. But then, you know, as time goes on, it gets a little bit easier to kind of manage all those expectations. You just go out there and play and try to do the best that you can, and really just focus on the game and not the magnitude of wearing the captain's armband. But for a guy that didn't get a scholarship into college, for a person that didn't get drafted, for a person that scrapped and fought all the whole way to get to the top, to be able to represent my country and then be the captain, it was a special moment for me and my family.
Awesome. And you won a couple of cups as well, didn't you? Is it MLS Cup that you've won as well?
I won MLS Cup. I won our cup competition. It's called the US Open Cup, which is like the FA Cup in England. And I won the Gold Cup, which is like our Euros with the US. And I got to play in World Cup and Copa America. Yeah, we're a little ways away from winning those competitions, but you know, we're inching closer.
Do you know what? I actually think America's got a lot right in terms of how it does with sports. I think that there's a massive controversy with the NCAA in terms of how that generates billions and doesn't pay the athletes. I don't want to get into that. That could be hours and hours worth of talk. But I do like the way that there's such a focus at that amateur leading into pro sort of pathway that's being developed. And I know football is such a grassroots sport over there still, but it does seem like a really sensible way for people to go from being complete rank amateurs to getting their first professional contract. And I'm not going to say it's better than the academy system that we have in the UK, but I think it's worth looking at least. What was your experience of those players that came through that and your own experience alongside that not being that?
No, I think you bring up a good point. I think what benefited me and the other players that went through the university system was that we had that buffer of learning how to become an adult that I think gets bypassed when you join an academy, because the goal when you join an academy is to get into the first team as soon as possible. And what's different about playing in the university or playing at the youth level is that you're kind of playing with your friends, you know, people you care about. It's not about the money. You just love to play. You're trying to move up the ladder, but your motivations are different. But when you get to the first team, now you're playing with men who are competing with each other and against massive other men who are trying to put food on their table for their families. And that kind of hunger and the money that's at stake is so much different than what you're facing when you're in university or the youth level. And I think that's a big jump psychologically as well. And I think what university does, that 4 years, not all players stay for four, but that having that couple of years to adjust from being a kid who grows up in your parents' home to stepping out into the world and having to deal with some stuff by yourself as an adult is important, because you're not doing everything by yourself, but you're doing some things. And then when you make that jump from university to a first team or into MLS or the national team or whatever it may be, I feel like you're a little bit more prepared and equipped to handle some of the adversity. And that's why, you know, it's part of it. And I think what's going to happen here in the States, as much as I do appreciate the benefit of that, the flip side and the negative side of it from a development standpoint is that we're not getting our youngest players into the first team as soon as possible. So they miss out on cutting their teeth, and really only the strong survive. And I think now to flip back to the good side of university, it provides you with a degree. So if things don't work out, at least you can fall back on a proper education and a network of people that didn't play sports that you got to meet outside of your team. And hopefully they can give you an opportunity to get into a different job space if football doesn't work out. I said almost at soccer, but I said football. So it's I can see that the plus and minus of it from a development standpoint. If I'm only looking at it as a coach, I think the academy system is the only way to go. But really? If I'm looking at it for how you develop proper human beings and people that are going to be better off and more well-equipped, which I guess from a coaching standpoint, you want mentally stable players. But I think the university has a lot to offer and has a lot of benefit. Now, I think what's happening with the NCAA is the problem here is the NCAA season at most is five months long. And that's just not enough. We need our guys playing all the time. So I know finally after 20 years, they're talking now realistically about changing the NCAA season so it lasts 8 to 10 months, which would be so much more beneficial to the development of our players here.
And more in line with what you're seeing in Europe. I think one of the major flaws that you've got in the academy system, you're looking at a single-digit percentage of players at 16 to 18 who are still in the game 5 years later, and that's an absolute tragedy, because these are some seriously talented kids that just end up on a scrap heap and out of the game. And like I said, most of the time, I think most are getting some college education, college in the UK, which is, I think, high school in America. but they're not getting degrees. They're certainly not going to. I would actually like to make a bet that it's less than 1% of professional footballers in England have got a degree, if that.
Yeah. And I would say here, I know that the average career span in MLS is 4 years. So you have a lot of guys that are falling out now. And what are they going to do? Most of them just go like, well, I'm going to go coach youth soccer or youth football, excuse me. And that's their only out. They've got nothing else, you know, unless they have a degree. And I've seen a lot of guys now who have fallen out of the league but had a degree go on to become lawyers and doctors and dentists and, you know, doing marketing or business or investing, you know, like doing legit jobs that probably paid them more than when they were playing, right? So we have that fighting against us too, is that the salaries aren't so high here that it's either all or nothing. Like you get in, you break into a first team, and you're set for life. Whereas here, you got to play about 10 years to kind of build up that equity to actually make it worth your while. So after guys fall out after 4 years, it becomes hard. And I've talked with the players. We have a players union here, and I've talked to them about developing a program, because I had a really hard time when I retired, because that's the only thing you ever identify yourself as is as a player. Your family only knows you as a player. Your friends, everybody just sees, oh yeah, he's the athlete in the bunch. And when that goes away, it's really hard. And I was a bit depressed, just to be really frank with you, about what do I do next. And I think what happens is your ego gets so big and you're so full of yourself about what you've accomplished that it's really hard to accept the fact that you have to start over at the bottom again. And I think that's where YouTube, for me, kind of moving on to this phase two of my life, I love that YouTube is so democratic that you can be anybody, anywhere, and just start making videos. And if you love it and if you're passionate and people find you, then you're going to be off to the races. So for me, it was a really nice landing spot because I knew I wasn't good to start and I needed to figure it out. And it ultimately had a lot of success when I was with Kick TV. And then that fell apart, my relationship there. So I started over and taught myself how to edit and all these other things. And all those disciplines and habits that I learned when I was a player are now coming out again, putting the hard work in, doing the things when people aren't looking, and then trying to make it look as easy as possible on camera, even though you're working your ass off behind the scenes.
You said something just before we came on, actually, which I think is really pertinent, which I think a lot of people probably need to hear, because people think that you get a few thousand views on YouTube and now you need to go start getting brochures for Lamborghinis and Ferraris, which couldn't be further from the case, could it? I mean, it's literally a pittance that you earn on the views from YouTube. And you said that you see your YouTube channel as a shop window for doing, for getting work with elsewhere, with either with brands or with other... You know, maybe a TV channel prop, perhaps, or something like that. And I think you bang on that, actually.
Yeah, I think I never looked at YouTube as when I broke off and started doing my own as a moneymaker. I had already heard things behind the scenes that they were going to start adjusting their ad revenue, which you're now seeing now. I didn't have any visions of grandeur that I was going to be KSI and the Sidemen and to be able to hit and strike gold like they did.
Oh, I think anyone with 10 million plus is doing pretty damn well. But yeah, for the rest of us, no, it's not paying a single
thing.
And
bill. I happen to be friends with a lot of big YouTubers, one of which is Casey Neistat. And we talk a lot about kind of that middle class in YouTube where you get to maybe a ceiling of 100 to 200,000 subscribers and you can't really push past that. And what do those people do? You know, they have to go get jobs at some point because, as you say, it's not a pittance, but it's definitely not a lot to live on. You know, my subscriber base, I'm getting up to 100,000, so I'm excited about that on a personal level. But I my expectations are tempered because I know that that's not where I'm going to make my hay, you know, and that I need to go and actively seek out job opportunities with anybody that I can. And to reference Casey again, you know, it's when you first get started, you have to say yes to everything, even if you think it's not really your bag. Like you don't say no to anything. You say yes to every single opportunity, no matter how small or mundane or whatever. And you make the most of it and you're going to learn something from it. And it's going to make you better moving forward. And that's where I was for a little bit. And now I'm starting to get to a point where I'm busy, so I can say no to a few things. I don't like saying no to things, but it's a good place to be. And so I look at YouTube very realistically. It's not going to be this end-all, be-all magic money that's going to explode. That time's over. I think if you look at the evolution of YouTube and content creators, I think for YouTube in particular, it's done. And Twitch is another possibility, I think, that people are looking into and other platforms. So it's an interesting time to be a YouTuber. But for me, I see it as strictly a platform to be able to talk to an audience and to talk to an audience in a fun, engaging way and to give them a chance to talk as well in the comments. I do encourage people to send me videos at times, so I'll use some of their user-generated content. And honestly, Stephen, it's a chance to be creative. So for instance, this is being really candid with you, I have a series called How I Did It, which really breaks down. I haven't done one recently. I think my last one was with Spencer Owen, where Spencer FC, where I did like a
name
kind of
drop
stuff
bingo
I did.
On here. Jesus Christ, we've had Perlo, Casey Neistat, and Spencer Owen. Where are you getting that free in this conversation?
Well, you know, it's funny. If you work, what's great about YouTube too, and I'll add this in before I get back to that story, is everybody's willing to help each other out. Like, there's a lot of collaborative energy, and there's nobody really trying to push the other person down. So I really appreciate that. So when I got introduced to Casey and got to know Spencer and all these other guys, and you start to build the relationship, because I feel like if you hustle, they understand the hustle. They hustle themselves. And if they can recognize that in you, then you're going to have a friend. And so I think we have a lot of shared struggles in some ways, but then also, like, we don't complain about it. We just put our heads down and keep going. So to get back to this How I Did It series, I really wanted to slice out a couple of things, a lot of questions I get. Like, people are like, hey, well, how did you become a pro? Like, Jesus, you know, that's a lot. There's a lot there. So why don't I just break it down? You know, this is what I did when I did like 1v1 attacking or 1v1 defending. And I, you know, broke that down. And then I did like a off-season training that I did with Spencer. I gave you guys some ideas and stuff like that. Now, for me, when I come up with these ideas, like how I did it for me is very sellable. So now that I've created this living, breathing thing, a series, I can now go pitch it to a brand and say, hey, listen, health brand, this is what I'm doing. I have an idea to do maybe 6 to 10 more of these. How would you like to come in and be involved and be the sponsor? You know, and sure, there's the sellout angle that you worry about when you're on YouTube, because everybody wants their content for free. But, you know, we're out here working hard too, and we're still creating free content. It's just with a brand so that we can get rewarded for our time and energy. So I think that's changed a little bit. I think the audience understands and knows that that's how it works. But it's been so that's just one idea that I have, right? And I think what's cool about YouTube is you have this kind of blank canvas every day to come up with an idea. You throw it up against the wall. If it doesn't work, you don't do it again. And if it does, then you're like, okay, how do I build off of that and make that stronger, or make it a piece of real estate that I might want to sell to a brand and do it in a fun way? Now, for instance, I don't know if you watch my FIFA career mode. I'm terrible at FIFA 17, by the way. But I knew
you might be
that,
better than me still.
It's terrible. I'm terrible. The show, though, I tried to flip FIFA. I was never going to be able to compete with the guys that do career mode on a regular basis or play Ultimate Team all the time and know the game so intimately and know it inside and out. I just don't have the time to do that. But I can make dumb, entertaining videos about career mode. And I have a blast. I'm like, I become characters. I'm doing all this stuff. And I actually had this company called Dollar Shave Club reach out to me and say, hey, listen, we want to get into your programming somehow. And I'm like, I don't know where that fits. Where I'm going to talk about Dollar Shave Club for a minute and a half. So then my wife, great idea. She's like, you should put it in your career mode. And then you can have some fun with it, because you get to be all these characters that I've created. And I'm like, that's a great idea. So we played Manchester United. I'm Arsenal right now. My second season in career mode. I'm Arsenal. I'm playing against Manchester United. And how I teased it was, hey, I'm playing against Jose Mourinho. I thought he went big time, got a lot of credibility when he became when he won his first title with Chelsea, and then he started doing commercials. Well, shit, I can do a commercial. So then I throw it to a fake commercial, and it's me doing a Dollar Shave Club commercial. Not making fun of them, but like doing a really sincere Dollar Shave Club commercial. It's me as the manager. It's really funny. So we have to shoot two commercials, and they paid me X amount of dollars for it. And I never thought I would ever get any money for career mode. And the fact that they're willing to invest in it and have some fun with us and allowed me to be creative with their brand has been really cool. So
I can't imagine selling out like that. But anyway, if you like this, make sure you hit the description and download BetBull and check out the bets that we're putting on Thursday night in the podcast. Anyway, carry on.
No, so that was it. I mean, that's just, it's all out there. It's just a matter of how creative you want to be and how open you are to being flexible, working with brands. And what kind of platforms are you on, and what kind of content are you creating on those platforms? I think you're doing a great job, and I'd be surprised if brands haven't approached you in some capacity to either do stuff on your platform.
I've knocked three back this week that I need to talk about.
I understand. But, or to ask you to do stuff on other platforms, you know? So it's That's the beauty of YouTube. I could go on and on about it, and when I go do stuff with other YouTube creators, that's all we talk about.
There's three that I've knocked about this week. One wanted me to do Keep You Up is with a pair of socks, and I was like, I don't think you've ever watched one of my videos, for starters, because I don't do anything like that. Another was a betting company, and I've got a couple of betting companies already on the go, and I was like, I can't do another one. And the third one was a yoga company, and I was like, you've seriously just blasted this out to a load of people, haven't you? I might be a poster boy for some things. Smashing things up might be one of them. Yoga and me, just, unless it's a parody of some sort, I was like,
that's it.
No, thank you.
Dude, I wish a yoga company would approach me. That would be amazing.
I'll put them on to you.
I would try to spin that as much as humanly possible in a fun way. I mean, you'd still have to convince them. It depends on who's running the brand, right, and the identity for them. You still have to convince them about, hey, we got to have some fun. If you want actually people to watch this, he's got to be engaging. You can't just say, hey, I'm Steven, look at my yoga pants. No, that would be funny. I'd love to see you in yoga pants. But like, it's just...
I look phenomenal in yoga pants.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you look A+. But I just, it's just kind of tilting it on its head a little bit to make it more engaging and make it more memorable, right? I mean, now that I'm doing fake commercials in my career mode, people are like, oh, I remember Dollar Shave Club, and that's it. And then I've done my job, and that's what they paid me to do. So yes, you're right. I did sell out, but it was fun, and I wanted to try to see how it went.
Let's go back to the football, because one thing that really does fascinate me is it's not just the patriotism, but I think that it's really took hold in football in the States with the US men's national team and the US women's national team, which is great to see as well. Is that because I think because of the core sports in America don't generally have national teams, that when you've had a football team that people can actually get behind, like the last World Cup as well, it was crazy. I was seeing people like live broadcasting stuff. It might have been yourself as well, actually. I saw people showing bars, which was absolutely packed with people wearing replica shirts. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you wouldn't have ever thought that America would take it to heart as the way it's done. Do you think the national team's a major driver in the success of MLS and vice versa?
Yes, I would say that U.S. soccer is more of a driver for MLS, and MLS is a driver for the U.S. men's national team. But that's going to change. That'll even out as our academy system gets more developed and more mature, and we start to develop more national team type players, right? I mean, I think the American people identify with now that isn't a goalkeeper is Christian Pulisic, who plays at Borussia Dortmund. And I think he's going to be a key player for us for a very long time, so I'm excited that he plays for us. But it's tricky. You know, I think what's interesting here is that we have an expectation when we support a sports league that it's the best sports league in the whole entire world. So the NBA is the best. NFL, nobody has another NFL. It's just ours. Baseball is only ours. Basketball, even though there's other leagues, it's still, you know, I think I said NBA already, but we are, and hockey, you know, is pretty much the best recognized league in the world.
About the CFL, the Canadian Football League, I thought that was pretty hardcore.
No, I mean, it's. I think it has its respect. It's almost like the second division, right, behind the NFL. It's kind of the best way to look at it. So I would see it like that. And then with the women's team, you know, they're an incredible story. There's so many talented women. They get to tell a really inspiring story of not getting paid the same as the men, always having to fight to get that respect, and then continuing to prove it by winning World Cups, by winning all kinds of different competitions. And it's fun. I'm so proud of them, and I'm proud to be friends with a lot of the players. But they have different challenges, right? They don't have a domestic league that's very strong. It's
a lot of them
and it's figuring out how they fit into that
Premier
landscape.
League,
huh? I mean, we already – what's that?
A lot of them are finding themselves in the English Premier League, well, or at City because of the money.
Right. Yeah, Carly Lloyd came in, and Heather O'Reilly's at Arsenal, ladies. So it's so things are starting to shift, and it looks like Europe's becoming more of a destination, which doesn't help our domestic league. Mm. But it was always a struggle when the domestic league here for the women didn't partner with MLS. The NBA has a women's league, and they're the WNBA, and I think it helps because they share the same stadiums and they share a lot of the same resources. Now, when NWSL partnered with MLS, or didn't partner with MLS, it just became a little bit harder, I think, because that was a relationship that I think needs to work together to help build both. I don't know if they think that the women's league is stealing dollars from the men's league. I don't know. That's a bigger conversation and something we could talk about more going forward. But yeah, our national teams stand out because, and I think from a casual fan, you have something you can sport every 4 years. So it's really easy to get hyped up for 2 weeks and put on a red, white, and blue jersey and get drunk with your friends and get all crazy about that stuff. We do it for the Olympics as well. So it's that's something that I think very patriotic to get behind your national team. And it's really easy to understand, hey, we're in the biggest competition in the world and we have three games and hopefully we get through. We're playing against some star players. Last time was Cristiano Ronaldo and hopefully we beat him, and people can get amped around that. It's a pretty easy concept. But, and because the World Cup's the biggest competition, that's obviously something Americans get into. But when you get into MLS, you're like, oh, wait. So there's a domestic league. Okay, there's no promotion relegation. So it's set up like you other U.S. leagues. We have playoffs. Then there's an Open Cup competition. And wait, there's the CONCACAF Champions. Like, they just completely confuses, I think, the casual American fan. Once you get in, you're in. But it's not that easy to convince people that have grown up on basketball and American football and baseball and hockey to a certain extent to all of a sudden adopt this very global game where we're not the best at it. It doesn't compute to our little small American patriotic brains that it's okay to join in on a conversation and be a part of a sport that's around the whole world.
I think a strong, we talk about it being a global game, but ultimately it's still centered in three or four countries in Europe, really, for the major money, TV rights and competitiveness. But I think a strong global game benefits the game globally. Like Brazil having a strong national league, Argentina having a strong national league, as well as North America having strong national leagues. And I think even if they do it correctly, China and Australia having strong national leagues is only good for the game globally. And then we've got to tackle what's going on in Africa then. There needs to be resources and players pumping things into Africa, because there's obviously good African players that are playing in Europe and probably in America as well. But it's not got any sort of globally recognised domestic game. And I think once you get that, then you've got a truly global game, because I think we kid ourselves a little bit that it's a global game. It's not really a level playing field.
That's true. Yeah, that's fair. No, I think you're right. And I think what hurts, when we talk about Africa in particular, I think what hurts is that the European teams and scouts are there trying to sell those players as soon as possible. And obviously we could get into a big conversation about how there's a lot of fake agents that will bring players up to Europe and then take their money and then just leave them there, which is the saddest thing I could ever imagine. Thinking you had a chance to go like train with Manchester City and some agent just, you know, makes you pay for everything, gives him some money to get you that opportunity, and then just doesn't show up and pick you up from the airport. Now you're stranded in a country, you don't know how to speak the language, and that must be brutal. And I can't imagine how many kids that happens to on a regular basis.
I would imagine it happens fairly regular, actually.
Yeah, right. And I mean, I say Africa, but I'm sure that happens not only there, but from all over. So it's, but I feel like that's more ripe there, and they promise these things, and it's a sad state of affairs, and I think that really undermines the infrastructure that's, if there's any infrastructure at all, of trying to build domestic leagues. And I think South Africa has a good league. Egypt has a stable league outside of any time it does get disrupted through, you know, political or social violence. Or, violence is the wrong word, but just, you know, some heavy stuff going on in the real world. And I mean, they have other, you know, there's other domestic leagues too that, but they don't stand out, right? They're not really on par with anything else. And it's hard. It's hard to get visibility here in the States to watch those. So, I mean, we get a lot of games here. We're actually pretty blessed, hashtag blessed, to have as many games and leagues as options as possible. But Africa's never on the docket or anywhere near it. And even when we have the Africa Cup of Nations, you know, it's very specific. It was on BN Sports here, and there's a pocket of people that care, but it's such a great competition. Just like all the other, you know, like the Euros and our Gold Cup and Copa America, it's just, they're cool. And there's a lot of history there. And you just wish that people were more educated and open to hearing about it. But people are so busy these days, it's not that easy to capture their attention. So, it's a difficult challenge. I don't even know where to take it because there's so many layers to it. But, yeah, it would help, ultimately, to your point, to have more stronger leagues around the world. But I think that from a domestic standpoint, our national team is going to benefit. So to give you an example, we have a lot of fans here that are like, oh, yeah, man, I support Liverpool and the U.S. men's national team. And I'm like, that's great. You know, you'll never walk alone. I appreciate that. Now, I'm glad you support the U.S. men's national team. But if you really want the national team to become better, you still have to go support your local team. Now, I know MLS, our country's so big here, so it's hard at times for that to happen. Somebody could live in Cincinnati, for example, and the nearest team's 2 hours away. But Cincinnati has a second or third division team in this country. Go support that, because that kid that could be playing there could be playing for the MLS team and for our national team in the future. I was an example of that. So it's important that support exists, that we're still trying to prop up the infrastructure here. that we don't just, MLS will never be like the Premier League, the best marketed league in the world. And maybe that's true, but it doesn't mean that it's not going to happen at some point. So there needs to be some purposeful support and knowing that, listen, this isn't what you're going to watch on TV with Liverpool on a regular basis. There's going to be moments of brilliance from some of these players at times that can match what's happening with Philippe Coutinho and Bobby Firmino and all those guys. But it's not going to be as sustained, right? Because those guys do it and have proven themselves and play for Brazilian national team or whatever it may be. But there aren't going to be times where these players need your support so we can continue to push on and build a nice, healthy, vibrant infrastructure that's going to end up, you know, supporting and helping our national team progress, which is the team he supposedly supports. So I get a little frustrated with those. We call them Euro snobs here, but I get a little, you know, just, I don't mind you support Liverpool. It's fine. I support Newcastle. But I'm also aware that MLS is important. The USL and our PDL system and everything underneath is important. And those things need our attention and love too. So, man, there's a lot to sift through. But ultimately, a strong domestic league can mean for a strong national team. And as you say, that's only a benefit to everybody.
Pre-Beckham MLS.
Yeah.
How much of an impact did him coming out there have, and was his impact greater than any other foreign import that you've had?
I would say yes. I mean, first and foremost, he's a celebrity. So when you add a celebrity to any situation, it's going to raise the awareness and visibility of what he or she is participating in. So not only, I guess it's two celebrities, right? Because you bring Bex over, you're going to get Posh as well. So it's like a two-for-one deal. What I think he did a lot that was unseen was he pushed for a lot of players' rights behind the scenes. Like, well, just in terms of how, like, certain players were being treated. And he could go into the Galaxy front office and be like, hey, listen, this is unacceptable. This is unacceptable. And they would be like, all right. You know, like, what are they going to tell him? No. So he started to up the game in that sense. And then all of a sudden, we would hear on guys from other teams, like, hey, did you hear the Galaxy is getting this? You know, hey, that we should be getting that too. That's only fair, or that's how it should be, or whatever it may be. So that's when the players' union started to really take shape and form and gain some strength, because I think he really brought to light that certain things needed to change, certain things needed to be more professional, and that I think that helped in so many different ways to help really start and propel the players to have a little bit more confidence to stand up for themselves, because we finally had somebody who had that global credibility, had been around, played at the biggest clubs, played for his national team, played in World Cups. Even though we had those types of players, we had nobody like him who could stand up, and nobody was going to tell him no. Nobody was going to say one thing to him about any of that stuff. So I really feel like he helped kind of, whether he would take credit for it or even knew that it was happening, it gave us confidence as the rest of the players to say, hey, he doesn't think this is good enough. Let's just stand behind that. And now we can start pushing that this little tiny rock and maybe make it a boulder at some point, where the league has to address some of these concerns. Because, man, there's some really bad stories out there about how players were treated, and I think he's helped.
Well, some of the wages was ridiculously low, wasn't it? Almost minimum wage, essentially, for people in the same team as Beckham was playing in at Galaxy.
Yes, well, that's one. Obviously, the pay discrepancy. You know, he helped bring in a new rule called the designated player rule, which is now expanded from one player to four. Which has kind of allowed us to break the salary cap and splash on some bigger players. And I think that was important from that standpoint, almost from the owner's perspective, be able to splash some more money. But then, yes, it did shine a light on the fact that what he was making in one day was the same as one of his teammates was making in a year. So that needed to be addressed as well. Now, I think that still happens a little bit, but at least the pay minimum has gotten up to more than a livable wage. I think it's like $70,000 to $75,000 a year. That's my guess. But when I first started, I made $24,000 a year, which was $800 every 2 weeks. So you know what the best part about that was, and it was fine. You know, at the time, that it is what it was. The league was just starting. I understood that I was an American playing in an American league. They tried to sell me the "we're doing you a favor by having this league," and if you don't have any options anywhere else, what are you gonna do? And I was really excited to be in the top league, you know, and my friends and family and all that. So all that stuff's really important. But I would say that, I lost my train of thought, but it was it was a crazy time. And you knew that you were part of something that was growing and there were going to be some growing pains. But I wouldn't change it for anything. I had a blast in those early years. Here's the story. So what happens is you go out, like you're this new professional team or you're a new professional athlete, and you're making $800 every 2 weeks. And when you go to the bar, if you go out to a restaurant, everybody just expects you to pay because you're a professional athlete making millions of dollars. And you're like, you just get stuck in all these situations to the point where we wouldn't even go out anymore because we didn't want to be put in that situation because we wouldn't have money to pay for rent or our own food. And we needed to pay for our own food to obviously have the strength to go perform so we could earn more money with our team. It's a real vicious cycle with regard to how you survive and what you needed to do to continue to play. Because for us younger guys, we needed to train probably twice a day. Or I would train in the morning and I would go hit the weights later. And you know, as a growing athlete, and you're trying to get bigger and stronger, you need a certain amount of food. And what I earned just didn't cover it. So it was tough. You have to go coach these little youth, the under 10 teams, to try to make ends meet and to try to have a little bit of that extra cash.
There's one thing that does impress me about what's going on with American soccer is that, so I've got a mate who works at Dallas Texans, and they've got, I can't remember, there's one figure, and I get it wrong, it's either 30,000 kids or 50,000 kids, and the facilities that they've got are ridiculous. And my son pays £20 a month in subs, which is nothing, it's £5 a week. And I heard over there they was playing $120 a month, so it's over $1,000 a year in their subscriptions, and that allows them to be able to have crazy good facilities, full-time professional coaches, and I think that ultimately is probably going to lead to the States overtaking England at the very grassroots stage at some point, and that and the sheer size and numbers involved, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. There is an interesting, I would say, negative to that, is that we get a lot of players who have the money to spend on all these things, and we miss out on the players that might be more talented but don't. So there has to be a balance of the pay to play, which is what you're talking about, versus going into the cities where the incomes are a little bit lower and trying to identify the kids that are already outside on the street playing every day, right?
Every month, that if you've got one kid, that's a bit steep. But if you've got two or three kids, you'd be like, guess what? We're not playing. Now we're going to go do swimming or something.
Exactly. But there are parents too that will pay anything to make sure that their kid gets on a team, and that becomes hard for a coach who's getting paid to say no to that person because the club's like, hey, we really need this. You know, this guy's paying $25,000-$30,000 more a year to make sure that his kid's playing. You know, and what do you say to that? So that becomes a little interesting in what your motives are and what you're trying to do with regard to development. We also have a big issue here, and it might happen in England as well, where we value winning over development. And I had to have, when I coached youth teams a few years ago, it was probably 5 or 6 years ago, I had to have a meeting with the parents. Like, this isn't about winning. Like, we have an under 10 team. They're not going to get college scholarships or get into the pros by winning the under 10 state cup. It's just not going to happen. What we need to make sure we're doing is doing all the right things that we're working on in training so that we continue to develop the player and then them develop as a group and learning how to move as a group and all the little things that have to happen to understand the game even better. And they just like, parent, I'm a parent too. And I get, like, if my daughters were out there competing, that you want to see them succeed and do well, and you don't ever want to see them struggle, but the struggle is where it's at. I mean, that's the best teaching moments. Anyway, that's a whole different conversation. So yeah, it's the pay to play model where I agree with you. I think what you're saying is very true. And there's a lot of advantages to having top facilities and being exposed to better coaches. However, because that is what drives it. It's a billion-dollar industry over here. There's no room, and there's not a lot of people dedicating time to finding the kids that actually see the sport as a way out of their situation. We have a lot of top athletes in football, or American football and basketball, because it's a way out. They're coming from low-income areas. They're like, I need to be a professional athlete because I can pay for my family. I can get my mom out of a bad situation. I can get my dad out of a bad situation. I can help save my family. And that kind of hunger, you cannot replicate if you're living comfortably in your suburb with your family and your parents that are paying the coach a little bit more so that you get to play. You can't. And that's why even when you see, we talk about Africa, right? When you have a player that comes out of Africa who, and I've seen him, I've gone over to Ghana and I've done some stuff in Accra before and this Right to Dream Academy, it's incredible, where they get these kids that are living out of a hut with 10 other family members. And that kind of hunger is just, it's impossible to replicate here in the States, where you have the luxury of so many different things. So it's finding that balance of because I kind of grew up that way too, but I was, since I was told that I was never going to be good enough, I had that type of drive and hunger that was a chip on my shoulder. So it just depends on where that comes from inside of you. And I think we need to make sure that we're fostering that kind of mentality, that hunger, because you need it, especially in the biggest games when things aren't going well, to still be able to fight through, not playing well or whatever may happen. But also identifying talent that has that kind of intangible hunger that you can't replicate just based on how they're growing up. And so we have some work to do here. And I think our scouting network could be better. And how much time do we have on this show? I mean, I could talk forever.
Well, I know a little bit about some of the scouting going on in the MLS at the moment, because I know that there's a couple of clubs that, well, I've been in contact with, actually, looking at players for them and with them, and I'm not going to say who, because I don't know if I'm allowed to say who, but I know that that's what they're trying to do. They're looking at Championship over here, they're looking at some of the lower-level European leagues, and ultimately I think that if the MLS is going to thrive and grow, that's where it needs to do. It needs to become the place where some young players aren't afraid to go, and the clubs that I've been involved with have tried to recruit 19, 20, 21-year-old players coming out of the top 10 academies in England, trying to get them to come. But unfortunately, a lot of those players still see that as like, whoa, hang on, I'm not 35. What are you talking about? I'm not going over there. If they can change that perception, that's when the MLS is really going to start to grow. And I think if they hit that right level of bringing certain players over and not just going for players going for a last payday, but actually somewhere that they can go and show what they can do in a way that the Scottish League does, in the way that the Dutch League does, and the French League used to do to an extent. I think if they treat it, maybe the Portuguese League as well, if they treat it a little bit like those leagues, go out there, go and get some good experience, go live in a foreign country as you've done yourself, and play the sport, and then bring that experience back. And I think players are going to find themselves at a much higher level if they do that. And I think that's what the MLS needs to do as a whole. And I think, well, I know that there's some clubs trying to change that themselves already.
No, I agree with you. I think you make a great point. And I think there needs to be an acceptance here by MLS that it's okay to be a league that's a stepping stone to the bigger leagues. You know, even the French league to a certain extent was a nice place for, let's use N'Golo Kanté, for him to develop and then be spotted. And then obviously he's doing great things for his own career and winning titles. And I think MLS needs to embrace that. I think we have an ownership group the leaders of the league are very entrenched in other sports where they think what they do is the best thing ever. And I think the more that we shake that mentality and just accept the fact that even the best, biggest clubs in the world sell their top players, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo got sold from Manchester United to go to Real Madrid. I mean, it happens to everybody on all sides.
Yeah, but Pablo, he didn't do anything Juventus. After he left us, did he? So who cares?
No. That's true. Yeah. What's his name again? But,
never heard of him.
You know, Pogba leaves Juve to go to United. I mean, that's just part of it. Like every team's in to sell and buy. And I think the more that we embrace that, as opposed to trying to act like we're not that, we'll be able to grow even more, as you say, for a lot of the same reasons. So I think one of our best success story is Sebastian Jovinko, who's playing, played for Juve and then came over to Toronto at a 26, 27. He's by far one of the best players in the league. And I wish that he still got called into Italy to kind of validate that it's okay to come to MLS and still play for your national team. I think he'd be fine. But, you know, there's a lot of that, as you say, that perception that we have to fight. And that's just going to take some time. And at some point, I hope that we can get there.
All right. We'll finish it on this one. How do you think Newcastle's going to do back in the Prem next season?
Great question. I'm happy that Benitez is staying on. Christian Atsu signed, or I heard rumored that he was going to sign a 4-year deal. So that's exciting to be able to sign some players, get somebody kind of start to form an identity. Obviously, we got that, but we're going to have to add to it to compete. Realistically, though, I just see us getting in the mid-table purgatory where you don't really, you know, you don't push for Europe and you don't get relegated. It's kind of where Stoke finishes every year. And I hope at some point with Benitez in charge, we can start to build off of that. My expectations are tempered in reality for season one. Let's just stay up. Let's see where it goes. Let's see how we can compete with those kind of mid-table teams. And then maybe we can pull some, you know, Pardue, Cisse, BS out of our ass and qualify the Europa League 1 year. But, I think that qualifying for those competitions is almost a kiss of death for some of the I don't call Newcastle a smaller club, but for the clubs that don't have the same kind of funds, because it's just need to compete with 23 guys.
Yeah,
you need a full squad, and I just don't think Newcastle. I think that really hurt Pardew back in the day when we got into Europe, because it just really depleted what we were capable of. So,
well, between him and the Ashley selling off all your best players every year, it's amazing that you're able to stay competitive when that's happening underneath a manager getting... It's not the shittiest players that go, is it? It's always the best player that gets wiped out from him, and it's incredible that they're able to stay afloat at all when that happens.
Yeah, I know. So hopefully Benitez can be... He already seems like he's gotten a little bit better control of Mike Ashley, and as long as we can open up the purse and be competitive, I think that's all we want as supporters.
All right, Jimmy, tell everybody where they can find you.
Oh, you can go on Twitter, Instagram, at Jimmy Conrad, JimmyConrad, or go to my YouTube channel. It's The Jimmy Conrad. You can just type in Jimmy Conrad and I'll pop up. My handsome
face. I'll bang the links in the description for everybody as well. How many are you off 100,000?
Almost. I got about 6,000 left to go.
I don't think the show's got the ability to do it. But lads, can you prove me wrong? Can everyone go and subscribe to me? Let's see how close we can get him to it by the end of this week.
Yes. Thank
right,
you so much.
Jimmy, this has been an absolute pleasure. Hope we've taught some of what's going on over in the MLS. Thank you very much for joining me. I'm sure we'll catch up with you again, maybe before the start of next season or as next season kicks off. Or maybe, do you know what? When United play Newcastle, that might be a decent...
That'd be amazing. Yes, that's a date. United versus United. It's on.
Alrighty. And thanks to you guys for joining us. Make sure to subscribe. Go and subscribe to Jimmy. Go and give him a follow on Twitter. Thank him for coming on. And we'll see you later.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.